This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Enterprise Biz Bytes. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm joined in the studio by
Arvind Yuvaraj
and Christine Wong
and a whole bunch of other technical people who are helping us out with some issues we have in the studio right now. But do stay with us. We're not going to be going anywhere. Our stories for today, we'll be talking about Google's new AI algorithm. Moving on to how Singapore, listen to this, have a budget surplus and are giving their citizens cash.
Because.
Wow.
Just because they can.
Fantastic.
It's not all as rosy as we might think, though. Something to do with phones in China and why the iPhone is losing out to Chinese devices in Asia is our other story. Then moving on to wooden skyscrapers, a story about how there are plans drawn up for the world's tallest wooden skyscraper. And then, of course, wrapping up with a story about nothing less than KFC deliveries in the UK.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right then, let's start off to let people know if you want to get in touch via WhatsApp, 018-789-8899. And of course, if you want to get us on Twitter, we are at BFM Radio. It'd be really nice to have a little bit of conversation whilst we're moving on. But Arvind, please do take us away with this new algorithm.
Yeah, so scientists from Google and its health tech subsidiary, Verily, they discovered a new way to assess a person's risk of heart disease using machine learning, and is by analyzing scans of the back of a patient's eye. So the rare interior wall of the eye, or something called the fundus, is full of blood vessels that can reflect the body's overall health. The software is able to accurately deduce data, including an individual's age, blood pressure, and whether or not they smoke. And Google and Verily scientists, they've analyzed a data set of about 300,000 patients. Then the neural networks were used to mine this information for patterns, and they started learning to associate telltale signs in the eye scans with the metrics needed to predict cardiovascular risk, like age and blood pressure. So that is so they're basically taking something that was pre-existing, like eye tests and eye exams, and they're using it to predict whether someone is at risk of having heart issues in the future. They can use this to predict whether even when the heart issue might occur for the person, for the patient.
They have a time frame.
Very vaguely, because they're doing tests like they're taking people who have had heart issues versus people who have not had heart issues, and then they're comparing what the back of the eyes look like, basically, and seeing who might be at risk in the future. So this method is slightly less accurate than what we use now. It's 72% accuracy of the scorecard that people use now. This method is at 70%, but the reason people are saying that they want to use this method is because it isn't invasive. You don't need a blood test.
Right.
And also that it uses technology that's already there. So when you go for an eye exam, that can be used to predict other issues that you have with your body, basically. The best part about this is that it says that it doesn't need a lot of time to implement, because if you already have the machines in the hospitals, then you can basically just implement the machine learning and the AI in the hospitals that want to take part in an experiment like this and see how far or how much it works with their patients.
And I'd assume that over time as well, with more data that is collected, something like this would end up being cheaper for consumers and for insurance companies and one thing or another, because you're not having to run through a blood test, so therefore you don't need labs and you don't need technicians. And
yeah. I don't know. The cost of how much they might charge for something like this is debatable, but they say that Google wants a process that doesn't involve humans at all. So they want to have it completely machine-based. So you go in, you get your eyes checked, and then by doing that alone, you get like a whole reading of what may or could be right or could be wrong with your body without having a person sitting there to tell you what's right or wrong.
Yeah, and I think by the very nature of machine learning as well, you know, the more people that put this into practice, the more accurate it will get over time by collecting even more data, right? So it kind of feels like there's not a lot of downsides to this, even though technically at the moment it's less accurate than like the pre-established, ideas that are in place right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's also, it'll be interesting to see how many people actually take this up, like, because they're testing it now with about 300,000 data sets from people. What they did was they took a retinal image of someone who had a cardiovascular issue and versus someone who didn't have it in the following 5 years. So not someone who has had it in the past, but they took this 5 years ago and then they tested to see which one of these patients would go through a cardiovascular issue.
Right.
And 70% of the time, the algorithm was able to pick out who was going to have the issue moving forward.
I mean, 70% is not something to kind of sniff at. That's fairly accurate.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And this is just the beginning as well. So, I mean, I do really feel that this is... like I said, right, the more that people sign up for this and are able to use it, the more that it'll get better. Mm. And also, I mean, would you guys want a thing to scan the back of your eye and tell you everything that's going to be wrong with you?
Yeah. I prefer that to a blood test, to be honest.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't like the blood test because it takes time. So I have to wait. The waiting for me is the worst part of any kind of medical exam. That's why if I go in...
Right.
Yeah, you know, so normally even when I want to go in for a test, I do it like way early in the morning. So even if they want to do other tests, they can't tell me that it's closed or the person has gone home.
Right.
And I go on like a Monday, so everyone's there.
Yeah.
So I get my results at the end of the day, or worst case scenario, the next day.
Smart.
Yeah, so if I do an eye test and it's even faster than the blood test, then I'd definitely opt for that if I'm looking for something. If I'm not looking for something, I don't know if I want to go get like a pair of glasses someone tells me that I have this whole...
It almost feels like you're going to have your fortune told.
Or
your misfortune told.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of love that though, because then you can be prepared. You know, and to know what might come in the future. Mm. And just to, you know, for example, if it is something that maybe you have to change your diet, maybe you have to change your lifestyle a little bit, just to try and avoid the chances of it actually happening, I think that'd be really useful. I'd like that a lot.
So you could counter it from not happening.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
You know?
Makes sense.
All right, we're going to take a short break. When we get back, of course, we'll be talking about how all adult Singaporeans will get a one-off bonus of up to 300 Sing dollars.
Because Singapore.
And if you want to get in touch, don't forget on WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or of course on Twitter at BFM Radio. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back in a minute. BFM 89.9.
Break from midfield. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bites. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm in the studio with
Arvind Yuvraj
and Christine Wong.
We're going to be with you all the way through until 1 o'clock this afternoon. If you do want to get in touch with us, get us on WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or of course on the Twitters at BFM Radio.
Yes.
So this is a story I picked up this morning from Today Magazine of all places. So here, I'll just read what it says. Every Singaporean aged 21 years and above this year will receive a one-off payment of between 100 and 300 Sing dollars from the government as the Republic expects a record surplus for the current financial year. Adult Singaporeans with an annual income of up to 28,000 Sing dollars will receive 300 Sing dollars. Those with annual earnings between 28,000 and $1 and 100,000 Sing dollars will get $200, while those drawing more than $100,000 a year will get $100. So anyone who owns more than one property is eligible for $100 regardless of income. The payments, dubbed the SG bonus, will be disbursed at the end of this year and will cost the government 700 million Sing dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a quote. It reflects the government's long-standing commitment to share the fruits of Singapore's development with Singaporeans. This is according to the finance minister. For the financial year 2017, the Republic expects its biggest overall budget surplus at 9.61 billion Sing dollars, owing mainly to exceptional statutory board contributions and higher than expected collections from stamp duties due to a recent pickup in the property market. But he did stress, we do not expect either to occur every year. It's not a structural surplus. We cannot base our long-term fiscal planning on the basis of exceptional factors being positive year after year. Very interesting, though. I mean, I was reading a little bit more around this. And it's not the first time the government have given cash payouts. In previous years, payouts of up to $800 were given in the form of growth dividends. But a little bit of research tells me that the tax rate is due to be raised to 9% sometime between 2021 and 2024. It's currently at 7%. They're going to increase the tobacco tax. They're going to add a carbon emission tax a little bit later on down the road. So this seems to be the kind of... I don't know how to put it, the calm before the storm almost. It's like the little, I'll give you on my left hand, and then a little bit later on, I'm going to take back with my right hand. But there's other countries that have done this as well. Hong Kong, back in 2011, they gave every citizen above 21 years old 6,000 Hong Kong dollars. There are certain states in Canada that do this quite regularly. You know, it's not all that unusual. I mean, it has hit the papers recently because everybody's gone, How is it that Singapore can do this and there are certain other places that cannot do this? What's the issue, you know? Mm. And I think that's kind of where the debate has been sparked online currently right now. How do you feel about this, Arvin?
I don't know. It's a good problem to have. I mean, you know, if you want
too
like,
much money, right?
Yeah, too
about,
much money.
I was
yeah.
about to say, it's like out of all the problems that a country can go through, it's like, oh no, we have so much money. We got to give it all back.
What
like,
are
come
we gonna
on,
do?
Guys.
Yeah. How would you feel? I mean, if you had like a storage space and then you went like, oh, you know, I need to buy new furniture. So can you just take all this money off my hands,
just,
you know,
just,
I wanna,
it's just for
you. Yeah. Just send it to your house with a truck or something. No, but I know, like you know, Malaysia and Singapore have like a friendly beef.
Do they?
Yeah. You couldn't tell. You couldn't tell.
It's no,
not,
I couldn't
not
tell.
Obvious.
Not at all.
Yeah.
At all.
So this we have a friendly beef, but it's it we can pick up a lot of things from Singapore and the way they manage.
No, there is a lot to learn. Yeah,
there's
I
a
agree.
Lot to learn. We may not agree with a lot of things that happen there, and you know, we might pick on certain
very
issues.
Strong policies.
Yeah,
that
strong
they have.
Policies and mm-hmm. stuff, but. If you look at the way they have managed their... It's always about planning. They always plan like way in advance, like 15 years in advance, 10 years in advance,
right.
5 years in advance at least. They let their people know like what's going on and what's going to come in the years to come and to prepare for that. And then they... I mean, if they have like a surplus of cash, it's just good financial management. Whether
right.
it's the calm before the storm, whether they're
right.
going to... I think Singapore is one of the highest... taxed countries in the world.
20%
or
something like that.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, though, it's not even an election year in Singapore.
Yeah.
You know, so that's something to take note of as well, I think.
Yeah, it's just... the tax thing is one way to look at it. I mean, they're, you know, making your citizens happy and then just putting on this, like, higher taxes. But then they also get the returns with the high tax.
Yeah.
So, you know, their education systems and just the basic quality of life in Singapore and how they are, like, the Southeast Asian platform to jump into other countries that people want to go to, you know.
I mean, we're talking about space development in Singapore as well last
week,
weren't we?
You know? Yeah, like a space hub in Singapore. So, you know, they are going places. There's no denying that Singapore is going places.
Mm-hmm.
Do Malaysians get jealous, do you think?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what it is that we see Singapore and they're really organized and transparent and it's nice and then the streets are clean and you look at Malaysia, you're like, I don't know, like, the food is nice.
Yeah.
And the food is nice, like, you know. So I think there is a definitely an element of jealousy, but I think, you know, instead of spending our time being jealous without actually doing something about it,
mm-hmm.
we can take a page out of their book and try and apply some of their principles. Not all of them, obviously. We don't want to end up completely mimicking them, right?
Mm.
But like in this case, I think imitation is definitely the best form of flattery.
Yeah, you know, it's like, you know, I like personally, I wouldn't be able to live in Singapore. Work in Singapore, maybe here and there. But living in Singapore, there's something about KL that is home, you know.
The
and
chaos
I would,
is kind of like
It's controlled chaos.
Right.
Yeah, you're
yeah.
kind of attuned to that kind of thing. Mm. But we can pick a few things that they do right. And I think it's more than jealousy, it's actually frustration that Malaysians have. It's frustration because we have so much potential and we have so many resources and we are so rich with everything, but we aren't on Singapore's level yet.
But the food's nice.
The food is undeniably nice. The food is undeniably nice wherever you go. You need you know, Malaysia has the best food in the world.
Yep.
That's not even a competition.
We're not biased at
all. Okay, moving over to the text messages. What have we got?
Yeah, so we've got a message in from WhatsApp, a number ending in 5440, about the first story regarding Google's new AI algorithm that just says, a health report card at the back of my eyes, what will they think of next? and I had to say it like that, right? No, but I mean, I think, you know, on the one hand, it sounds kind of ridiculous, but you know what? If it's going to come from the back of your eyes and be informative, then fine.
Yeah.
Do whatever to the back of my eyes, guys.
Yeah. As long as it's not doing anything harmful, you know, just shining a light over there, picking some data.
And no needles. You know, a lot of people hate needles.
I also hate needles.
Time for a break. Some music coming up. It is Joe Strummer and the Mescaleros. This is Coma Girl here on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Bankers, financiers, and moneymakers. BFM. 89.9.
Welcome back to BizBytes, ladies and gents. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm joined in the studio by
Arvind Yuvraj
and Christine Wong.
Again, we're with you all the way through until 1 o'clock. If you want to take part in the conversation, get us on WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and on Twitter at BFM Radio. Moving on to story number three, why the iPhone is losing out to Chinese devices in Asia. Tell us more, Christine.
Honestly, I feel like this shouldn't really come as a surprise to anyone, but the main obstacle is the iPhone X's price.
Of course.
So its sea price may be hobbling its future in Asia's biggest markets and allowing Chinese challengers to grab market share. So the thing is that China's manufacturers are increasingly churning out higher priced devices that compete directly with Apple smartphones. So instead of looking at these Chinese smartphones as like the lower priced alternative, they're actually offering up things that are pretty much on the same level at this point. These phones will have high-end features but carry lower price tags. They'll have robust hardware such as metal bodies, beefy batteries, and special cameras for taking better selfies. Mm-hmm. Because, you know,
priorities.
Priorities. For example, in India and Indonesia, Apple's market share has remained stagnant since 2013, while Chinese makers like Xiaomi, Oppo, and Vivo have been actively gobbling up new customers. And then even here in Malaysia and the Philippines, Thailand and Vietnam, Apple has actually failed to make big market share gains they've lost market share in recent years. Mm. And Oppo and Vivo especially have made rapid progress because they have these models that specialize in the selfie cameras and software, and they cost like $100 or less than even the most inexpensive iPhones. So I think the problem is that really what it is that Apple isn't actually aimed at the mass market in emerging Asia, because in the US, for example, you know, telecom companies subsidize devices.
Correct.
So it makes sense to like get the contract and the phone all together in one package. They don't do that here. Mm. So there's not actually a lot of incentive to pay such a massive price, you know, up front for this phone when you can get a cheaper one from China and it has a lot of the same features and also selfie camera.
And considerably cheaper.
Yep. Exactly. The thing is that Apple's, you know, prices have helped its revenues grow 11% last quarter in the Asia Pacific region, but its market share itself has been stagnant or declining in most Asian markets. Take, for example, in China, Apple's market share is roughly 8% now from 13% in 2015. And then in India, Apple has had just a 2% market share since 2013. In Indonesia, it's fallen to 1% from 3% in 2013. Looking on the other side of the coin, Xiaomi has jumped to 19% of India's market today from just 3% in 2015.
Wow.
So this is a statement from Xiaomi's product manager for India. They say that Xiaomi has an edge in many markets because it can customize for each country, while Apple creates the same products for everyone. While Apple has tried to do a little bit of customization here and there, they've fostered the development of mobile apps and mapping services in India, and also iPhone supports several local Indian languages. Xiaomi, for example, has created special chargers for its smartphones that can handle India's fluctuations in power supply, for example. Mm-hmm. And also, it's tweaked its software to weed out advertisements so users don't miss personal texts. A lot of their models come with two SIM card slots so people can save money. Some of the models also have SD memory card slots so people can use their own music, videos, photos. And, which I love a little bit, I'm not going to lie, Xiaomi announced at a launch event earlier this week in New Delhi that it has tweaked its selfie beautification software so it doesn't erase bindi forehead decorations or nose rings, mistaking them for blemishes.
Really?
Seriously. This is an actual feature that needed to happen, but it shows that they're really putting a lot of thought on how to appeal
into localization.
You know, and make things localized.
Right.
But Apple's not doing that. And not only that, but they're not even, you know, releasing any sort of statement on what their strategy to conquer the Asian market is. And like, hello, Asia is big continent, please. You know, try harder.
You're speaking about how some of these the phone companies were looking at language and localization,
yeah,
and doing it in a whole bunch of different Indian languages.
Mm-hmm.
Did you read the recent problem with the, there was a certain character, Telugu character, that if you sent it to an iPhone user,
yes,
it would crash their phone.
Yeah.
You know, and it would reduce it to the springboard and you could not open your messages. And it's still an ongoing problem. So it's, you know.
So it basically bricks the phone.
It bricks the phone.
I mean, we've seen these kind of like text glitches in a sense, you know, quite a few times before with Apple devices specifically.
Correct. Yeah.
Because they're not built to handle these particular characters or anything. So I really feel like, you know, this is such an interesting thing because like I'm an iPhone user and I'm getting really frustrated with it, you know, for various reasons.
Yeah.
But now to know that not only are there alternatives out there that aren't Samsung or, you know, but also to know that they're roughly on the same level and lower price, it's really incentivizing me not to buy Apple devices ever again.
Have you ever had an Apple device, Arvin?
No.
Never.
No. Because every time I go and Because for me, I just need, I have my checklist. I just need it for messaging. I just need to check stuff online whenever, and maybe things like Instagram and Facebook. So
right.
for just these four basic things, I don't even play a lot of games on my phone. So to pay that much for an Apple device or even a, my first smartphone was Samsung. I used it for like 3.5 years
uh-huh.
and then I switched to the one that I'm using now. And it's funny that you talk about like Xiaomi and their devices, because I'm using a Xiaomi. I don't think I will ever go back to the high-end phones. That's just a personal choice, because it does what I want it to do, and the battery life is amazing.
Right.
Yeah, I can go out in the morning with like 30%, and when I get home without charging, it's at like 15%.
So, wow.
Yeah, and then I just plug it in and it charges in like an hour, like 45 minutes to full. So I don't think, you know, when you talk about like China makes and all, that's the first time that I'm looking at it. And then I went like, okay, so these phones are not your cheap alternatives that people just pick up. These are not your disposable phones anymore. Huawei, I think, is coming out with the first three-lens camera phone. So they've got three lenses at the back, one for color, one for contrast, and one for something else. So their cameras are extremely powerful. If you look at their ads, they had like Henry Cavill and someone else, Scarlett Johansson, I think, in some of their campaigns for their P2 and stuff. So it's not, they're not, they used to be the cheaper alternatives or like the knockoff phones, but now they're at a level where they are on par with
competing at that level.
Yeah, yeah. Even the OnePlus was called the iPhone killer, the OnePlus 2, and then they came out with the OnePlus 3.
And let's also clarify that they're not discontinuing their lower priced models with less features. They're just creating more options, as opposed to Apple, which is like, oh, now your old iPhone is dead and we're not making any more parts for it, so just you have to upgrade, ha ha ha.
Okay, I mean, I'll put my cards on the table. I've been an Apple user for a very, very long time, and you know, I was one of those people that when the iPod was first launched, I was using what was known by then as an iRiver device, you know, and it could play every single kind of format. It was playing you know, MP3s and MP4s and .ogg, all kinds of stuff. And I was like, this is the future, a device that can play anything. But the thing is, it was complicated, right, to use the software that came bundled with it. Then the iPod came along, and it was super simple. You put on in one particular format, it does everything you want. It's got this really simple interface, and I love the idea of them stripping away everything that you didn't need and just giving you something that just did what it was supposed to do. And I think that's been the strength of Apple for the longest time. But now we're in a situation where they're almost entirely ignoring a continent, you know, and because of that, their sales are going to plummet, and because their sales are going to be plummeting, it's going to mean that there's going to be no move towards R&D and giving us something nice and new, and we're going to be stuck again with perhaps Chinese phones at some point that are going to go in a full circle again and be overly complex again.
Yeah, I think
with
that's
three lenses and things.
Yeah.
But I think that's really the key element of this issue, is the fact that, you know, the first iPhones gave you what you needed.
Exactly.
And what Apple is doing now isn't giving Asia what it's needing. And they're not even at all trying to make a statement of like, oh, we see that you guys might, you know, benefit from so-and-so feature. Whereas, you know, brands like Xiaomi clearly are listening to their consumers and trying to give them what they need.
Yeah. Xiaomi had a problem with their other devices like the Mi Fit. So it couldn't get the pulse of people with darker skin. I think this happened like last year. So they tweaked it with the Mi Fit 2 or something. To be able to be used by people with darker skin. So because they tested it on people with much lighter skin when they came out with the first product.
Right.
So they do that with all their phones. Xiaomi has a factory in India. I think they opened it last year. It's in Andhra Pradesh or somewhere. It hires single mothers, people from underserved communities and stuff, and to manufacture the phones for the Indian market. So you can see that they adapt. iPhone, you can argue that they make like stronger looking devices, but I think they are failing to adapt. So they are doing what they've always been doing over the last 5-10 years, but they are not exactly changing their ways to mold to a different market.
They're selling them to middle class white people in America, essentially, is what they're doing, right?
Yeah, pretty much. And tying them into these phone contracts with these telecom companies, where, you know, that makes sense at least, you know, but they're not really giving the Asia Pacific market any reason to continue to support them.
Mm. Yeah, and I think they've boxed themselves into that thing where Steve Jobs used to be all about the aesthetic, and he used to be very strict about what goes into his devices and what languages go into his devices, and that has sort of boxed Apple into their own little corners. So they're not able to adapt to other countries because they'll have to tweak their design or even the design of their software to be user friendly to people in other countries. So it's kind of a lose lose situation for them at this point.
All right, let us know what you think, folks. Get us on WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or of course on Twitter at BFM Radio. Time for a short break. Some music coming up from the Specials with Nightclub. When we come back onto our fourth story, plans have been drawn up for the world's tallest wooden skyscraper. Not entirely sure how I feel about this, but we'll have more on that in just a few minutes. Don't go anywhere. BFM 89.9.
Bureaucratic failures multiply. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bites. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm joined in the studio by
Arvind Yuvraj
and Christine Wong.
We've been asking you all the way through the show to send us messages and to get in touch, of course, via WhatsApp on 018-789-8899. Had a bit of a discussion just a few minutes ago about some of the issues that Apple and the iPhone are facing in the Asian region. We've had a text message from
a number ending in a 9515 who says, phones like Huawei, Oppo, and Vivo are giving consumers good value with good technology, lots of R&D behind them, and they churn out new models very fast, adapting to consumers' needs and wants. Apple is still stuck being proud. Take it or leave it attitude. Doesn't work anymore. Preach.
True, mm-hmm. True.
Preach.
True.
Yeah.
I think that's what we've been saying, right? Isn't
it?
Even though I'm a bit of a fanboy. Even I have been looking at alternatives. So if you do have an alternative suggestion, let us know.
What is it about Apple's phones that you like? Is it the sturdiness?
The solidness of it.
I'm just kind of stuck because I've had an iPhone since I encountered smartphones in the first place. So I'm so used to it that I kind of feel it has to be the next option. But I'm slowly getting really sick of it.
Go on then, Arvind. It's moving on to this story about how plans have been drawn up for the world's tallest wooden skyscraper. This sounds like something out of a comic book.
Yeah. But they actually want to build this. It's not too soon. It's in 2041. A Japanese company called Sumitomo Forestry, they are planning to build the world's tallest wooden skyscraper called W350 to mark its 350th anniversary that will fall in 2041. The tower will be used for offices, shops, hotels, and even homes. So 10% of the 70-story tower would be steel, combined with about 180,000 cubic meters of indigenous wood, which is enough to build about 8,000 homes, and there'll also be trees and plants on balconies at every single level. The projected cost of the building is about 600 billion yen, which is about twice the cost of a conventional skyscraper of the same size today.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But
I'm guessing that cement is cheap, I suppose.
I guess. And I think it's harder to get wood that's supposed
that
to...
That amount.
Of that quality, but Sumitomo expects the cost to fall because of technological breakthroughs between now and then. Because there's what? It's 2018, 2041. There's about
20-something years.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. So they've also prepared for earthquakes, which is a problem in some parts of Japan. There'll be a brace tube structure, diagonal steel vibration control braces at the center of the wood and steel column to protect the building. And at the moment, there's a 53-meter block of student flats in Vancouver, which is the world's tallest wooden skyscraper. Not very tall.
I'm going to say 53 meters is fairly tall, but it's not 70 stories, is it?
It's not. So this is I guess this is going to be one of their monuments in the Japan skyline.
Don't use the word monument, because when you're talking about wooden buildings.
Oh,
maybe
gosh.
Which does bring us on to something, one of your concerns, Christine, right?
Okay, honestly, maybe it sounds really simplistic, but my first thought was, if you live in an apartment and the apartment is made of wood and you light one candle and the candle fall over, wood burns, guys.
I mean,
very basic level.
Yeah. I mean, we were thinking about the fire hazard and stuff, but then you said it'll be...
Of course it'll be treated.
But I'm kind of in a place where if you really want to create, a really big gesture to do with the forests and trees and stuff for your upcoming tree 150th anniversary. Anyway, sorry. But like, you know, plant, like actually plant like a forest maybe? I don't know.
Yeah.
Don't continue to chop up wood to make a skyscraper when we are already running out of wood in the first place and all.
But you are right though. It will look beautiful on the skyline compared to, you know, traditional steel and cement structures.
Yeah,
it will. But for me, it's like it ties in with what you just said. Don't keep cutting down trees to build other things, because we are at that point where I think it's 50-50. We consume ebooks and we have like traditional books. And as much as I like traditional books, I want ebooks to become like the thing,
right?
And for books to be completely obsolete, because then you know it's
using. Listen to him, Christine.
Yeah, no, I mean I love holding like physical books, but you know when that happens, then there's a lot of you get to save a lot of trees in the process. Yeah. But I don't want this to be something that other people follow. Like everyone starts to build their own wooden skyscrapers because of some benefits. I don't think we need wooden skyscrapers. We have wooden houses, and they're like benefits. I think temperature control and stuff, but I don't think people need wooden buildings per se. But then again, if you talk about like buildings made of cement and like glass and other things, then there's a whole other argument of you know, the manufacturing of that causes like pollution and dust, all sorts of other byproducts that come out. So I don't know, it's a weird debate.
Interesting stuff. A wooden skyscraper, who'd have thunk it? Right, time
the
for
Japanese.
A break the Japanese time for a break. Some music coming up from Jimmy Barnes and INXS with Good Times when we get back. Our final story of the day, Chicken Chaos. More on that in just a few minutes. Don't go anywhere. BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
Final story of the day here on Biz Bites, and I'm feeling a little chicken. Tell me about it. Mm-hmm. Chicken chaos then.
Chicken chaos as KFC closes outlets. Now, don't panic, everybody.
No.
It's not here.
Oh,
thank God.
Not my nuggets.
Okay.
Moving on.
Okay. But KFC has closed more than half of its 900 UK outlets after delivery problems meant that they ran out of chicken. Mm. So the one thing that they're supposed to sell, they ran out of the thing. Last week, the fried chicken chain switched its delivery contract to DHL. Until last Tuesday, KFC's chicken was delivered by a South African-owned distribution group, Bidvest, which describes itself as the leading supplier of logistical and supply chain solutions to the UK hospitality and restaurant sector. And DHL is just blaming, quote-unquote, operational issues for the supply disruption. Yes, because what else would it be?
Mm-hmm.
It's unclear when the delivery problems would be rectified, a KFC spokesperson said, and the workers are being encouraged to take holiday but will not be forced to do so. However, that only actually applies to restaurants owned by the chain. It doesn't actually apply to any of the franchise things,
mm-hmm.
and 80% of KFC outlets are run on a franchise basis, so who knows? Mm-hmm. No one knows what's going on with KFC at the moment.
There's a little, I saw they posted something on Twitter as well.
Yeah.
The chicken crossed the road, just not to our restaurants.
They posted that
on Twitter.
They did.
Oh, you have to give them credit for.
They're trying very hard to address the problem, and they have been very transparent. And they've said that, you know, we've brought a new delivery partner on board. They've had a couple of teething problems getting fresh chicken out to 900 restaurants across the country is pretty complex. We won't compromise on quality, so no deliveries means that some of our restaurants are closed and others are operating on a limited menu or shortened hours. But I'm really in a place where it's like, if everything was going well, why would you need to switch, you know, your delivery contract in the first place?
Mm.
And apparently, the GMB union said that it had actually tried to warn KFC that switching from Bidvest to DHL was a mistake. The change led to 255 job losses and the closure of a Bidvest depot, said Mick Ricks, that's a name, a GMB national officer. He said, Bidvest are specialists, a food distribution firm with years of experience, and DHL are scratching around for any work they can get and undercut them. KFC are left with hundreds of restaurants closed while DHL tries to run the whole operation out of one distribution center. 3 weeks ago, KFC knew they had made a terrible mistake, but by then it was too late. We also have a WhatsApp message in from Kyril Nizam, who just says, you guys just gave me a lunch idea. I'm on my way to KFC to eat 20 chicken nuggets. I mean, I'm glad.
Only 20?
I'm glad that this emergency situation can inspire your appetite. But this is just, if anyone listens to Biz Bites on a regular basis, you guys know I'm a big fan of fried chicken, and this is an emergency situation.
My favorite thing of this, though, is at the end of this article. So this is a quote from somebody on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Yeah.
One KFC customer, Claire, said she was surprised when she went out with her children at the weekend weekend, quote, we went on Saturday night to our local KFC in Luton and queued for about 20 minutes in the drive-thru, about 15 cars in the queue, and when we got to the actual counter and asked for our standard family bucket, we were told there was no chicken. The kids, who are nine-year-old twins, they wanted chicken and clearly it wasn't available, so we said there's nothing available that we wanted and we had the joy of queuing to get back out again. Oh, no.
Yeah. How many outlets have closed?
So it says more than half, but they haven't actually released the number of, but if it's more than half, it's about 500 outlets out of 900 maybe, which is ridiculous.
If KFC plays their cards right, they can make this into like a huge marketing campaign, like the chicken is back or something.
Yeah.
You know, like complete full-blown promotion. Get people in free chickens to apologize for, you know, their mess up and stuff like that.
What they have done is they've set up a webpage where fans, I guess, can find the nearest outlet that is still open. But I agree, this would be a really interesting thing. And we've seen time and time again KFC come up with really creative marketing ideas.
You know who we've seen come up with smarter creative ideas? Nando's. Nando's would be all over this, you know.
Yeah.
And if
they're
not, they should be listening. Nando's.
Yeah. Yeah. So if KFC can pull a page out of their book and then do something that just, you know, makes fun of themselves and then go that, you know, it was a mess up. They're only human, but, you know, come and get their chicken again. They could get double the people than they
for
got before interested in them. And it's the US doesn't like KFC's marketing. They have an issue with their comedic take on like the Colonel and stuff. But Japan loves it.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you can like import or export marketing strategies from other countries, your other KFC outlets, they could make this into like a huge, like they could collect all the money that they lost if they wanted to.
You might say they'd get bucket loads.
Yay!
Oh, yeah. All right, it's time for us to wrap up, but let's quickly run through the stories that we covered. We started off with Google's new AI algorithm. What's it for? What's it do?
It scans the back of your eye and then it tells you if you are at risk of cardiovascular disease.
That's very simple and very effective.
Mm-hmm.
70% success rate.
70%, yes.
Second story, all adult Singaporeans will get a one-off bonus of up to $300 because they've had a record surplus for the current financial year. Lucky you, Singapore.
Yep, and then our third story was about why the iPhone is losing out to Chinese devices in Asia, and basically it comes down to the problem of they don't want to do anything to fix things.
Yeah, and then we spoke about how the world's tallest wooden skyscraper will be built in 2041 in Japan.
And then we wrapped up with chicken chaos.
Chicken chaos, as KFC in the UK has had to close more than half of its 900 UK outlets because they don't have any chicken.
No. Okay, finally, don't go anywhere though, because coming up after the 1 o'clock news, of course, is the Breakfast Grill replay. So his name is John D'Agostino. He's the managing director of DMS Governance, the world's largest governance fund. He founded a digital assets group and industry association that aims to create best practices for institutional trading of crypto assets and also regularly advises global regulators on best practices. He joined the Breakfast Grill to share his insights on the future of cryptocurrencies and digital assets. If you're into that kind of stuff, it's a must listen. And if you missed any part of this show, don't forget you can download the podcast. It is available on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Meanwhile, some music coming up from Cage the Elephant. This is Mess Around. My name is Rich Bradbury. On behalf of Arvind Uvaraj and Christine Wong, you have been listening to Enterprise BizBytes on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.